Chapter 70. The setting sun was suddenly snuffed out by the clouds. The sky went dark and menacing. Pitt and Giordino stood on the old track bed, listening to the deep rumbling of the storm as it drew closer. And then lightning crackled, and the thunder echoed, and the rain came. The wind swept through the trees with a demonic whine. The humid air was oppressive and charged with electricity. Soon the light was gone, and there was no color. Only black, pierced by brief streaks of white. Raindrops, hurled in horizontal sheets by wind gusts, struck their faces with the stinging power of sand. Pitt tightened the collar of his raincoat, hunched his shoulders against the tempest, and stared into the night.
"How can you be sure it will appear?" Giordino shouted over the gale.
"Conditions are the same as the night the train vanished," Pitt shouted back. "I'm banking on the ghost having a melodramatic sense of timing."
"I'll give it another hour," said a thoroughly miserable Chase, "and then I'm heading back to the boat and a healthy slug of Jack Daniels."
Pitt motioned them to follow.
"Come on, let's take a hike down the track bed."
Reluctantly, Chase and Giordino fell in behind. The lightning became almost incessant, and, seen from shore, the DeSoto looked like a gray ghost herself. A great shaft of brilliance flashed for an instant across the river behind her, and she became a black outline. The only sign of life was the white light on the mast that burned defiantly through the downpour. After about half a mile, Pitt halted and tilted his head as if listening.
"I think I hear something."
Giordino cupped his hands to his ears. He waited until the last thunderclap died over the rolling hills. Then he heard it too, the mournful wail of a train whistle.
"You called it," said Chase. "It's right on schedule."
No one spoke for several seconds as the sound grew closer, and then there came the clang of a bell and the puff of the exhaust. It was drowned out momentarily by another burst of thunder. Chase swore later that he could feel time grinding to a stop. At that moment a light came around a curve and washed its beam on them, the rays eerily distorted by the rain. They stood there, each seeing the yellow reflections on the face of the others. They stared ahead, disbelieving, yet certain it was not a trick of their imaginations. Giordino turned to say something to Pitt, and was astounded to see him smiling, actually smiling at the expanding blaze.
"Don't move," Pitt said with incredible calm. "Turn around, close your eyes, and cover them with your hands so you aren't blinded by the glare."
Instinct dictated they do just the opposite. The urge for self-preservation, to run or at least throw themselves flat on the ground, tore at their conscious senses. Their only bond with courage was Pitt's firm words.
"Steady. Steady. Be ready to open your eyes when I yell."
God, it was unnerving. Giordino tensed for the impact that would smash his flesh and bones into a ghastly spray of crimson and white. He made up his mind he was going to die, and that was that. The deafening clangor was upon them, assaulting their eardrums. They felt as though they had been thrust into some strange vacuum where 20th-century reasoning lost all relevance. Then, as if by magic, the impossible thing passed over them.
"Now!" Pitt shouted above the din.
They all dropped their hands and stared, eyes still adjusted to the dark. The light was now aimed away and traveling down the abandoned track bed, the locomotive sound diminishing in its wake. They could clearly see a black rectangle centered in the glow about 8 feet off the ground. They watched fascinated as it grew smaller in the distance and then turned up the grade to the bridge, where it blinked out and the accompanying clatter died into the storm.
"What in hell was that?" Chase finally muttered.
"An antique locomotive headlamp and an amplifier," answered Pitt.
"Oh, yeah?" grunted Giordino skeptically. "Then how does it float in midair?"
"On a wire strung from the old telegraph poles."
"Too bad there has to be a logical explanation," said Chase, sadly shaking his head. "I hate to see good supernatural legends debunked."
Pitt gestured toward the sky. "Keep looking. Your legend should be returning any time now." They grouped around the nearest telegraph pole and stared upward into the darkness. A minute later, a black shape emerged and slipped noiselessly through the air above them. Then it melted back into the shadows and was gone.
"Fooled hell out of me," Giordino admitted.
Where did the thing come from? Asked Chase. Pitt didn't answer immediately. He suddenly stood illuminated by a lightning strike in a distant field. The flash revealed a contemplative look on his face. Finally, he said, You know what I think? No, what? I think we should all have a cup of coffee and a slice of hot apple pie. By the time they knocked on Ansel McGee's door, they looked like drowned rats. The big sculptor cordially invited them in and took their wet coats. While Pitt made the introductions, Annie McGee, true to expectations, hurried into the kitchen to rustle up coffee and pie. Only this time it was Cherry.
What brings you gentlemen out on such a miserable night? Asked McGee.
We were chasing ghosts, Pitt replied. McGee's eyes narrowed.
Any luck?
May we talk about it in the depot office? McGee nodded agreeably.
Of course. Come.
It took little urging for him to regale Chase and Giordino with the history behind the office and its former occupants. As he talked, he built a fire in the pot-bellied stove. Pitt sat silently at Sam Harding's old roll-top desk. He'd heard the lecture before, and his mind was elsewhere. McGee was in the midst of pointing out the bullet in Hiram Meacham's chessboard when Annie entered, carrying a tray with cups and plates. After the last scrap of pie was gone, McGee looked across the office at Pitt.
You never did say whether you found a ghost.
No, Pitt replied, no ghost. But we did find a clever rig that fakes the phantom train. McGee's broad shoulders drooped, and he shrugged.
I always knew someone would discover the secret someday. I even had the local folks fooled. Not that any of them minded. They're all quite proud of having a ghost they can call their own. Sort of gives them something to brag about to the tourists.
When did you get wise to it? Annie asked.
The night I came to your door. Earlier I was standing on the bridge abutment when you sent the phantom on a run. Just before it reached me, the lamp blinked out and the sound shut down.
You saw how it worked then?
No, I was blinded by the glare. By the time my eyes readjusted to the dark, it was long gone. Baffled the hell out of me at first. My gut instinct was to search the ground level. That only added to my confusion when I failed to find tracks in the snow. But I'm a man with a curious streak. I wondered why the old rail bed was torn up and hauled away down to the last crosstie, and yet the telegraph poles were left standing. Railroad officials are a tight-fisted lot. They don't like to leave any reusable equipment behind when they abandon a right-of-way. I began following the poles until I came to the last one in line. It stands at the door of a shed beside your private track. I also noticed that the headlamp was missing from your locomotive.
I have to give you credit, Mr. Pitt, said McGee. You're the first to hit upon the truth.
How does the thing operate? Asked Giordino.
The same principle as a chairlift on a ski slope, McGee explained. The headlamp and a set of four speakers hang suspended from a continuous cable strung along the crossbars of the telegraph pole. When the light and sound package reaches the edge of the old Deauville Bridge, a remote switch shuts off the batteries and then it makes a 180-degree turn and returns to the shed.
Why was it that some nights we only heard the sound but saw no lights? Asked Chase.
The locomotive headlamp is rather large, answered McGee. It's too easily detectable. So on moonlit nights I remove it and run only the sound system.
Giordino smiled broadly. I don't mind admitting Chase and I were ready to take up religion the first time it paid us a visit.
I hope I didn't cause you any unnecessary inconvenience.
Not at all. It was a great source of conversation.
Annie and I stand on the river bank nearly every day and watch your salvage operation. Looks to me like you've experienced problems. Have any pieces of the Manhattan Limited been pulled up yet?
Not even a rivet, Pitt answered. We're closing the project down.
That's a shame, McGee said sincerely. I was rooting for your success. I guess the train wasn't meant to be found.
Not in the river, at any rate.
More coffee, anyone? Annie came around with the pot.
I'll take some, said Pitt. Thank you.
You were saying, McGee probed. Do you own one of those little motor cars the railroad gangs ride on when they repair track? Pitt asked, changing the subject. I have an 80-year-old hand car that moves on muscle power.
May I borrow it along with your phantom train gear?
When do you want to use it?
Now.
On a stormy night like this?
Especially on a stormy night like this.